WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Did you know that Mae Questel, who did the voice for Betty Boop, also did the voices for Olive Oil and Winky Dink? Or that Mel Blanc, before he became the voice of Looney Tunes, created Woody Woodpecker's laugh? My guest Charles Solomon has written a history of American animation called Enchanted Drawings. He tells the stories behind the old and new cartoon characters and their creators. All the cartoon innovations of the century are detailed, from Winsor McCay's pioneering turn-of-the-century Gertie the Dinosaur cartoons to Walt Disney's 1928 Mickey Mouse cartoon Steamboat Willie, which ushered in the sound era in animation, from the eccentric humor of Bugs Bunny to the technical achievements of Roger Rabbit. Solomon is a former cartoonist who now writes for the Los Angeles Times. The 1930s and 40s were the golden age of cartoons, but by the late 40s, cartoon studios were starting to close. I asked Charles Solomon why.
Well, the biggest factor was a Supreme Court decision that struck down the practice known as block booking. Under that practice, if a theater owner wanted to get a studio's big feature, their equivalent, say, of Star Wars, they would have to take a second feature, which was often what would be charitably termed a B-picture, very often a newsreel, and a cartoon as an entire package or block of films. And the studios just took a percentage of the rentals they received for the entire package and used that to finance their animation studios. When the Supreme Court said that was unconstitutional, unfair trade practices, and they could no longer do it, the theater owners had the option of paying so much for each element of the program, and they simply weren't interested in paying enough money for the cartoon for an animated film to earn back its costs on its initial release. The studio owners were very short-sighted in that they didn't realize that a good animated film has an almost indefinite shelf life and can be re-released and re-released and re-released over years and decades and make far more than its original costs. They're simply spread over a longer period of time. There was also a lot of pressure from exhibitors at that time to keep the double feature to a certain length of time exactly so they could schedule more films and more screenings of the films. The idea in the 30s of the huge all-afternoon extravaganza with many films and shorts and stage shows had fallen by the wayside after World War II. So the animated cartoon, which was a uniquely American contribution both to the art of animation and to film comedy, was sacrificed on the altar of expediency and quick profits.
Well, the end of the animation studios coincides with the early days of television. Was it understood early on that TV was this great potential market for cartoons?
No, I don't think anyone foresaw the importance of TV either for reruns of old theatrical shorts or for new production. In the early 50s, CBS bought the entire Terry Library, which was hundreds and hundreds of shorts that had been made over the last several decades, for $3.5 million. And everyone thought Paul Terry had pulled a real sharp deal there and was making an enormous amount of money off films that had been on the shelf for so long. And instead, those films have been shown thousands of times on television and would have been worth far more if he had rented them.
No, Paul Terry did Heckle and Jekyll, Mighty Mouse.
Heckle and Jekyll and Mighty Mouse. They were never known for their extraordinary quality, but he produced a great many of them, and they were a standard item in the theaters, and very soon became a standard item on TV.
Now, I grew up watching a lot of the Warner Brothers cartoons on TV. How did the Warner Brothers cartoons end up on TV?
Once again, Warner's made deals with the television studios, allowing them to broadcast their shorts. There really hadn't been much of a market for a long time for the black and white films from the earlier days, and those were the first things that got dumped into the kiddie show market. In the early and mid-50s, kind of a generic kiddie show began, where you would have a host dressed in whatever his particular costume was, as a clown or a cowboy or miner or whatever, who would introduce a program of old theatrical shorts. So they saw these cartoons over and over and over again.
A lot of children in the 50s grew up knowing Mickey Mouse because of the Mickey Mouse Club, which recycled a lot of the Disney cartoons. Can we use this as an opportunity to talk about the origins of the character of Mickey Mouse?
Certainly. And television certainly gave Mickey a new lease on life. He began as a very rowdy little character. Disney had started out, first he'd done a series that was live-action animation combination called Alice in Cartoonland. Then his first purely animated series involved Oswald the Lucky Rabbit. But it turned out Disney didn't own that character, the distributor did. And when Disney tried to get more money for his films, as even back in the silent days he was interested in making better films with better animation, the distributor said, no, you're going to take less money, or we're going to take this character and give it to someone else. So on the train ride back from New York, Disney supposedly came up with the idea of Mickey Mouse, and he told a very good story about it, that it had been based on a pet mouse named Mortimer. And when he got back to Hollywood with the idea, his wife supposedly said that the name Mortimer was either too sissy or too fancy or fussy, and so they changed it to Mickey.
Wasn't Mickey Mouse an important transitional figure in the transition from silent to talkie cartoons?
There had been some experiments with sound and animation before Steamboat Willie, but typical of Disney, he waited until he could get everything perfectly synchronized and really exploit the possibilities that sound offered. Paul Terry had made a film a few months before Steamboat Willie called The Dinner Party that had had sound and generated no interest at all, whereas Disney had scored that film very carefully. It had Carl Stalling, who was an old theater organist and ultimately went on to write the scores for almost all the Warner's cartoons, write the music specifically for the cartoon, and Disney even sold his car to help pay for that soundtrack. And there was a marriage there of image and sound that really excited people. Steamboat Willie was an immediate hit and a big hit, and people suddenly realized that sound and animation could be blended that skillfully in this country. And afterwards, I'm sure silent cartoons seemed very dull and has been passé, worn out. And so when, as I say in the book, when Mickey whistled Steamboat Bill at the opening of that cartoon, he really was sounding the death knell for the silent cartoon.
Charles Solomon is my guest, and we're talking about the subject of his new book. It's a history of animation titled Enchanted Drawings. Another character that made the transition from movie theaters to television very successfully was Betty Boop, and that was one of Max Fleischer's characters. And you describe her as being the first really feminine animated character. And I was trying to figure out why it took so long for a female to be a star of a cartoon.
Well, the early silent characters had basically been males. A lot of them were taken from comic strips, which again tended to have predominantly male casts. Also, it's much trickier to animate a female figure convincingly. The early figures, if you think of Mickey Mouse and Steamboat Willie, or some of the other very early Bosco's girlfriend, Cookie, for example, they're basically the male character with high heels and long eyelashes and a skirt. What set Betty Boop apart, she was animated by a man named Grim Natwick, who had done a great deal of studying of just pure formal drawing and art in Europe. And he knew how to draw the female figure, and he understood how it moved. And so he was able to give Betty a really convincing feminine grace. When you watch her walk, you realize that's a female's walk. It's in the way her hips are structured and the way they move, the way she adjusts her weight because she always wears high heels. It's a truly feminine kind of motion. And Betty was, an enormously popular character in the 30s and is enjoying something of a renaissance right now, where she's kind of the epitome of the late 20s, early 30s flapper figure.
But her character was, the sexuality of the character was toned down by the code of the 1930s. Can you describe the code? Was it the same code that regulated movies?
Yes, it was the Hays Code that forbade certain practices on the screen. And Betty had started out in a strapless dress with a garter on her left leg. And under pressure from the Hays office, she suddenly got a rather demure dress with a high neck and a collar. Her skirt was lengthened and the garter disappeared. In the early films, a kind of comic sexuality is the main theme that recurs. For example, in Red Hot Mama, where she dreams that she goes down to an inferno, she gives a devil the cold shoulder and literally makes hell freeze over. In The Old Man of the Mountain, she jumps out of her dress and reveals frilly undies that she's wearing underneath. So she was, her sexuality and her femaleness was very much a part of that character in the beginning, and her attractiveness as a character.
We've been talking about cartoon characters that made the transition from movie theaters to television. Let's talk about some of the cartoon characters who were created for television. And you trace this back to around 1949 when Crusader Rabbit was created for a TV series. And it was created by Jay Ward and Alexander Anderson. And Jay Ward later went on to create Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Yes, Jay Ward, who died just a few months ago, gave us what were unquestionably the best and funniest shows made for television. They were all done in very minimal budgets. Crusader Rabbit in particular was little more than a slightly animated comic strip. But the writing was so good and the voices were so interesting that you didn't care if the visuals were on the sloppy side. Rocky and Bullwinkle was actually made in Mexico under a very strange arrangement with General Mills. The company owned the films. They didn't own the characters, but they owned the films themselves. And they discovered they could save about $500,000 a year having them animated on the cheap in Mexico City. So they very hurriedly set up a studio there, and the directors stayed in Los Angeles and made little drawings indicating key poses. And as Bill Hertz, who was one of those directors, told me, how the animators got from one pose to another was their worry. So it was done very cheaply and very sloppily, but carried on the strength of those wonderful scripts that were written by some of the people who went on to write the Norman Lear comedies, things like, you know, the Mary Tyler Moore Show and All in the Family.
Let me ask you about Hanna and Barbera, the team who created Rough and Ready, Huckleberry Hound, Yogi Bear, the Flintstones. You trace their work back to MGM. They used to work for MGM cartoons. MGM did what, Tom and Jerry?
Yeah, they did. Well, they did the Tom and Jerry series. The first Tom and Jerry, Puss Gets the Boot, was the film that brought them together as a team. And they kept making Tom and Jerry's for the next several years until MGM closed their studio about 1956.
So Hanna and Barbera contributed a lot of the original, you know, made-for-TV cartoons. What, in addition to the characters they created, what do you think were their main contributions to the form?
Well, they certainly contributed a great deal to the industry of animation, realizing that they had to do things on a budget and on a deadline. They found a lot of ways to do things cheaper and more quickly, and really began the process of what's called runaway production, that is, sending material overseas to be animated and inked and painted because it can be done more cheaply there. There are larger labor pools and lower wages. I don't know that their television shows have contributed a great deal to the art of animation, but to animation as an industry, they really paved the way for the Saturday morning factories that have dominated television animation in this country ever since.
Do you have a short answer for how TV animation on Saturday mornings got so bad?
Well, there are two questions there. Do you want to know why is it bad or who's responsible for making it bad?
Well, how about a little of each?
Okay. The first one is very easy. It's bad because there's no reason for it to be good. It's very profitable the way it is, so there's no reason to improve it. As for who made it bad, there are four groups who are responsible, the first being producers who accepted low budgets and unrealistic deadlines rather than putting their foot down and saying, we can't give you anything of any quality on this. There are the networks who set those budgets and those deadlines. They don't sign contracts for shows until late April and even early May, and those shows are due in September. So there's simply no way that if you have to make 13 half hours in less than 6 months, there's no way to do that with much quality. The third group are the pro-social values people who, in the name of promoting good things, have caused networks to eliminate much of slapstick comedy and dramatic tension in the name of eliminating violence. Now, they did do a lot of good things in terms of integrating the casts, both racially and sexually, and creating more positive images, but they also took a lot of the fun out. And finally, there are the parents who allow their children to watch programs they feel are inferior. If they don't think their children are getting a fair deal or a good program, they have an ultimate veto with the off knob. And if enough parents say, I'm not going to let my children watch your shows until you improve the quality, then perhaps they will improve. But as it is, children are allowed to watch them or left with an electronic babysitter, and there's no reason to make them better.
You had referred to the Hays Code of the 1930s, and part of that code's effect on cartoons was to make Betty Boop less sexy.
Mm-hmm. And for the centaurettes in Fantasia acquired flower bras as a result of that. They had originally been designed bare-breasted, but an imaginary creature could not go out without an imaginary bra.
Now, recently, there was another code instituted that regulated what could be shown in cartoons. When did that code come in, and what did it have to say?
Well, I think you're talking about the standards and practices codes the networks adopted during the 60s and 70s. And their aim was to take violence out of cartoons and to introduce pro-social messages, to introduce positive role models into the Saturday morning shows, which had been pretty vapid and pretty mindless. And while they remained vapid and mindless, they now had more positive roles for the girls in the cast, the little girls or the adult women. There were more black characters, there were oriental characters. Characters began to confront some of the problems children might have to deal with, like bullies or liars or show-offs or someone, say, cheating and trying to get others involved. But those codes also led to some very silly things being done, such as censoring the old Bugs Bunny shorts and taking out the explosions or the pies hitting the face or Yosemite Sam catapulting into a wall. And as Chuck Jones, a three-time Oscar winner from Warners, has pointed out, everyone under 50 in this country grew up on those cartoons. Children watch a couple of hours of those a week. If they were really that deleterious, the effects would have shown up sooner and more dramatically.
Is a lot of the physical comedy in cartoons, the violent physical comedy, still being edited out?
Yes. If you watch the old theatrical cartoons that are on Saturday morning still, it's just cut out. The films are cut to smithereens. In some of the new shows that are made for it, everything seems to happen off camera. You know, you'll see somebody go careening off in a car or whatever, and you'll hear an off-screen crash and the ground will shake, and then he'll drag himself back in. But that sort of conflict or action isn't allowed to be shown on the networks. Now, in the off-network syndicated shows, the first-run syndication, things are a little bit looser. Those shows are made as packages and then sold, whereas the networks insist on approving scripts and having approvals all the way down the line. So it's a much more restrictive atmosphere for making the films.
Charles Solomon is my guest. He's the author of a new book on the history of animation called Enchanted Drawings. Do you regret that so much of the animation now is so targeted at children, whereas I think the original cartoonists thought of themselves as, you know, turning out cartoons that would be seen by children and adults in movie theaters? And I think that's part of what's given those cartoons a timelessness.
Very much so. What we think of as the classic shorts from Warners or Disney or Fleischer or MGM were made before the idea that a G film meant the dog has puppies in the last reel, and that's the high point. Those films were made for big general audiences, and they were designed to appeal to the least sophisticated member of the audience as well as the most sophisticated member. And during the 70s, animation got the very wrong-headed label in this country as a mindless entertainment for children, which it needn't be. The other problem I have with targeting children for the films is that means that many of them are nothing but promotions for toys. For example, the three Care Bears features were designed to sell Care Bear products, and every Care Bear was on the screen for at least a few minutes just so the audience knew that, you know, that one existed too and they could buy him. And I think that's a very wrong thing to do. I think that's exploiting children. And I don't think it's fair, and that children are innocent in many ways, regardless of the society we live in. And to pander to them that way is neither good filmmaking, nor does it result in good animation. As profitable as those toys are, the producers still won't spring for a decent budget. So the children are not only getting pandered to and sold to, they're getting done so very cheaply and sloppily. Whereas, for example, when He-Man first hit the screens, that was the first syndicated, made-for-syndication animated show. In 3 years, the toy company sold $500 million worth of toys, and as much again in related merchandise. Well, there are countries that don't produce $1 billion worth of goods in 3 years. Yet those films were still made very, very cheaply, and when they finally brought out a feature based on He-Man, it was all recut TV footage. You wonder how much money do they have to make before they're willing to give something back to the consumers and particularly to the children. And yet there's been much more outcry about the supposed violence in the old cartoons than there has been about this these marketing films and marketing TV shows.
Well, Charles Solomon, I want to thank you for talking with us about the history of animation. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Charles Solomon's new book is called Enchanted Drawings. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.